everybody, and welcome to the Kluwen webinar, Superfund on Tribal Lands, Issues, Challenges, and Solutions. It's part of the NARPM Presents series, sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. This series presents select presentations from the National Association of Remedial Project Managers National Meeting. I'm Mike Adam. I'm from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and I am moderating today's seminar. Before I introduce our speakers for today, there are a few logistics that I need to go over, and you can see most of these on slide number 2. If you are using a phone line, please mute your phone. Do not put us on hold. If you do not have a mute button, you can use star 6 to mute. During today's Q&A sessions, those of you on the phone can take your phone off mute to comment and ask questions. At that time, you may hit pound 6 to unmute. For today's presentation, there are several Q&A sessions interspersed during the presentation. The easiest way for participants to ask questions is to type in questions by using the question mark icon at the top of the HTML presentations. You do not need to wait until the Q&A session to submit questions via this text form. You may also use this form to alert us of any technical problems you may be having. The presenter will alert you to which slide we are on, and you'll have to manually advance each slide. If you're using the HTML online version, you can navigate the presentation with the arrow buttons at the top of the screen, as also shown on slide 2. You should have already clicked the Go to Session button at the top of the seminar homepage. After today's session, you can access the feedback form and the additional resources links from the sidebar buttons on the seminar homepage. We have also provided a convenient link to these on the last slide of this presentation. We appreciate your feedback and ask that you please fill out the form. In addition, if you wish to receive a printout receipt of your attendance, you can print the confirmation form that is displayed after you filled out this feedback form. This event is being recorded, and it will be archived on the Kluwen website. Within 1 to 2 weeks, you'll be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. You may subscribe to our Kluwen podcast to receive new archived seminars as they become available, and you may subscribe to all our RSS feeds by navigating to the News Feeds page. By going to the Kluwen homepage, clicking on the RSS News Feeds button on the Staying Connected right-hand sidebar. Today's speakers are Anna Abbey is a facilitator, trainer, program advisor, and project manager for EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. Her focus is on strategic approaches to Superfund cases and working with environmental justice and tribal issues. Anna received her master's degree in public administration and a certificate of advanced study in conflict resolution from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, and her BA degree in political science from the University of Minnesota. Teresa Michelson is a mediator and facilitator with more than 15 years of experience working on complex public policy cases and community mediations. Teresa is currently a partner at Mediation Solutions and over a private consulting firm and has served as an environmental scientist for the Washington Department of Ecology for 5.5 years until 1998. She has served as a facilitator on projects relating to waterfront construction and redevelopment, land use, facility siting, allocation of liability, solid and hazardous waste issues, natural resources damage, dredging, and regulatory streamlining. Teresa has 120-plus hours of continuing education in facilitation, negotiation, mediation, and legal training, along with her degrees in science and engineering, including chemistry from Caltech, master's degree in geology and geochemistry from MIT, and a PhD in environmental science and engineering from UCLA. And with that, there's one more reminder to mute your phone, star 6 if your phone doesn't have a mute button. And with that, I'll turn it over to today's speakers. Anna?
Thanks, Mike. Hello again, and welcome everyone to today's session, Superfund on Tribal Lands. My name is Anna Abbey, and we also have on the line Teresa Michelson, who will be presenting with me today. As Michael mentioned, Teresa is a mediator and facilitator working out of the Northwest, and she is also the neutral responsible for researching and writing the report off of which this presentation is based. And she'll be popping in later for another segment of the presentation. But we'll start off with an introduction and go from there into the goals of alternative dispute resolution processes on Superfund sites involving tribes, substantive issues brought up in the report, process issues, results, recommendations, and then we'll do a wrap-up. And as Mike mentioned, we do have sections interspersed for questions on the phone, but if you do have questions going through, go ahead and submit them via text, and we'll try to incorporate them as we go along. Slide 5. This presentation is based off of the Superfund and Tribal Lands Report, an assessment prepared for EPA's Conflict Prevention Resolution Center by Teresa Michelson, and it was completed in September 2010. CPRC, which is Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, is an internal EPA office that supports the agency's mission through alternative dispute resolution, collaborative problem solving, and public engagement efforts. The purpose of CPRC is to make agreement easier and to engage the public. We do this by coaching and advising, and consulting with clients about their environmental cases internal to EPA, and providing access to mediators and facilitators through our contract, and teaching EPA staff and managers skills to help prevent and diffuse conflicts in their environmental projects. So why were we interested in this topic? As the office responsible for, slide 6, excuse me, as the office responsible for environmental conflict resolution, or ECR, for EPA, CPRC was interested in learning more about ECR services done on Superfund sites involving tribes. We hypothesized that given the unique government-to-government relationship, the remoteness of many tribes, and what we knew about both EPA and native cultures, that mediation and facilitation would be particularly helpful in these situations. We were curious as to what elements of mediation and facilitation were seen as helpful, and what unique challenges might exist in this context. What we found in this study blew past our expectations. We learned not only about the conflict resolution field, but also about the state of EPA and tribes' current understanding of one another, where tensions lie, where expectations are not being met, and some recommendations for how to improve the situation going forward. Here are some of the terms that you will hear throughout this presentation this afternoon. Mediation. Mediation will be used in this presentation as a shorthand for mediation, facilitation, arbitration, or any use of a third-party neutral to improve communication. You may also hear the use of the term ADR, which means alternative dispute resolution, or ECR, environmental conflict resolution. These terms have come to refer broadly to this field of work. You also hear us refer to Superfund. Specifically, in this context, we're referring to sites that are under the CERCLA authority. In tribal lands, we'll refer to American Indian nations, tribes, bands, villages, or other groups whose reservations, communities, or traditional fishing, hunting, and gathering lands and waters are affected by Superfund sites. Slide 7. The goals of the assessment were to identify how ADR is being applied at Superfund sites where tribes and tribal communities are involved, to identify common issues and challenges faced in these situations, to understand and describe the ADR approaches used and to what extent they were effective, to learn more about the successful outcomes of ADR approaches as well as unsuccessful outcomes, and to gather recommendations on how to improve our work with tribes on Superfund lands. Slide 8. To begin the assessment, we first sought out cases in which ADR was used on Superfund sites involving tribal interest. The vast majority of these cases are located in regions 9 and 10, which is consistent with the number of tribes, native corporations, and reservations located there. EPA regions 1, 2, 5, and 6 also identified some sites involving tribal lands or interests. We had hoped to represent a variety of geographic locations, site characteristics, issues, and participants, but ultimately were limited by the number of cases meeting the three primary criteria, which of course is ADR, Superfund, and tribes. We do not currently have a listing of all Superfund sites that involve tribal interests or tribal lands, and found it hard to find specific cases with these three things unique. 9 sites across the nation met the qualifying criteria for these, and for these sites, follow-up was conducted to identify participants and obtain permission to include in the site assessment. 2 sites were screened out, one because the parties declined to participate due to litigation, and the other because parties cannot be identified who had current memory of being involved in that mediated process. So 7 sites were ultimately included in the assessment. In addition, interviews were invited to add perspectives on the interview questions from other similar sites that they had been involved with. For each of the seven sites, EPA staff, tribal representatives, and mediators were identified who participated in a mediated or facilitated process regarding the site. In many cases, multiple individuals representing EPA or the tribe were identified and scheduled for interviews. In a number of cases, EPA or the tribe also included legal counsel in the interviews, just to be safe. In one case, an individual from a state agency was also interviewed due to the integral participation of that agency in those negotiations. Ultimately, 22 separate interviews were conducted involving 27 interviews. Anonymous interviews were then abstracted for the report so that all parties could feel comfortable sharing their thoughts openly without fear of any reprisal or people knowing the details of their specific opinions. Slide 9. The interview questions followed a general order with specific questions tailored to each specific group and to the site specifically, as well as to the progress of the interview. Broadly, the interviews reflected our goals for the assessment and looked at factual site details, site-specific issues and challenges, personal involvement in the site and the mediation process, the structure, benefits, and risk of the mediation process, what worked and what didn't, and recommendations to mediators, EPA Superfund programs, and generally people working in this field. Slide 10. So what did we find? The rest of this session will be dedicated to the results of the assessment, starting with why did they initially choose alternative dispute resolution as a source. Slide 11. Through the interviews, we found that parties had many reasons for initiating AAR. Mostly, they wanted to build their working relationships and improve communication. In many cases, communication had completely broken down, and the relationships between parties had greatly suffered. It was difficult for EPA to figure out what tribes most needed to know about EPA's processes or what were the most important issues for the tribes. The worst cases had intense public meetings in which there was name-calling and threats, either physical or also litigious. In some cases, litigation had already been initiated, and so that adds an extra layer of complication. In other less tense situations, there was simply a lack of progress because people weren't able to communicate well. The elements of improving working relationships and communication include they needed to increase trust, reduce conflict, better understand issues, better explain decisions, and generally have everyone be on the same page. And so these were what brought them to seek out ADR. There was also substantive reasons for initiating ADR. Slide 12. Participants also usually had concrete tasks that they hoped to accomplish. These included, but not limited to, completing the remedial investigation or feasibility study or record of decision, establishing a community advisory group, identifying and resolving site-specific issues, identifying priorities for interim actions, allocating liabilities, or obtaining buy-in for decision-making and meeting tribal goals. And the last two can be problematic for the ADR process. If positions are inflexible before the process begins, then ADR might not be the best tool to achieve those very specific goals that parties might have coming to the table. The notion of obtaining buy-in for EPA decisions is particularly problematic when it comes to working with tribes. Most tribes are acutely aware of a legacy of broken promises by the federal government and have a hard time trusting their federal partners. If they commit time and energy into a process that promises a fair playing field for discussion and idea generation and has the potential to meet some of their goals, but then the process turns out to be biased from the start, it may add to the sense of injustice and deepen their distrust. Tribes are also likely to enter the process with specific points that are non-negotiable. Issues regarding sovereignty, jurisdiction, and culture may be better served by consultation, policy changes, or legal actions rather than the ADR process. Ultimately, an ADR process is well used when all parties have room for negotiation and are willingness to hear the other parties' interests and concerns and work with them. If those base standards aren't met, then the process is not necessarily the most effective tool. Slide 13. We have a little time here. If there are any questions, this would be a good time. Are there no questions? Then we can move on to slide 14, and I'll hand it over to Teresa.
Hi, everybody. This part of the talk will focus on the substantive issues that we encountered in these ADR negotiations. Not only what the main issues, but I'm going to focus on those issues that are qualitatively different from other sites, because most of you I know have experience with Superfund sites, but there are just a lot of really different issues associated with Superfund sites on tribal lands, so I'm going to try and go through those. That was slide 14. Slide 15 introduces some of those issues. Probably one of the things we heard most often from tribes was that they had a different worldview from EPA and other parties involved in the process. They really felt a strong sense of stewardship for the land that they did not always feel that everyone else shared in the same way that they did. In particular, tribes have a limited land base because of their reservation status, and it was very important to them that what little they had be protected and preserved for the long term, particularly when, in the living memory of the tribe, their land base had been restricted so severely by previous federal actions that left them with just what they had. Countering that, from the EPA side, there was some concern about fairness and consistency with non-tribal Superfund sites. This was less of an issue for the tribe. Tribes generally felt that there were strong, the EPA represented the federal government, which had a tribal trust responsibility to the tribe, and that it was not necessary to be always consistent with non-tribal sites. However, EPA site managers had some difficulty with that and really felt a responsibility to be consistent with national policies and procedures. That created some conflict. Tribes were generally interested in incorporating tribal lifestyles, cultures, and spiritual practices into risk assessments, and it wasn't always clear to everyone how to do that. This is an area that's getting more attention lately, but at the time, there were still very few examples of how this had successfully been done. Generally, there are some practices that have no counterpart outside of tribal cultures, and they often result in lower risk levels. So this is very important to the tribe in terms of setting cleanup standards for the site. One of the things we found, especially in the western sites, which were really a large majority of the sites that we were dealing with, is that there were a lot of large mining sites, and these present special issues. They have huge areas and waste volumes of contamination. There are often people living directly on or in the sites, to the point where sometimes sinkholes were appearing in villages. Children would be playing in waste piles. You know, this would be affecting their drinking water and resource gathering. And these were resources that are not easy for the tribe to replace, given their limited reservation land base. So they were very interested in having a very thorough and complete cleanup of these mining sites, which is, of course, incredibly difficult and expensive. So that area always caused a lot of discussion. There was also concern on EPA's part about the potential risks associated with such a thorough cleanup, the number of truckloads of waste that would be, you know, passing through communities, and that kind of issue, where to dispose of the material, transportation issues. Obviously, cost was a big issue there. Sometimes the tribes felt that remedies were being selected largely based on cost, and that really shouldn't be a factor. Of course, Superfund requires balancing of cost and technical feasibility with environmental protection, but that's an area where the tribes are often in fundamental disagreement with Superfund, just from a policy standpoint. There was some concern about the lack of funds in the EPA Superfund and how that was influencing the selection of remedy. For example, if a more complete cleanup would be very costly, and and that more complete cleanup would be driven by tribal cultural issues and concerns. There was some fear that a PRP who was participating voluntarily might choose to walk away from that voluntary cleanup, litigate, or otherwise, you know, refuse to participate, leaving EPA to hold the bag, basically, for that cost of cleanup, and the orphan sites fund not really having enough money to accommodate a cleanup of that nature. So EPA, in some cases, was reluctant to enter into a ROD that, aside from all the technical issues, would result in such a costly cleanup. Another area of contention had to do with soil and land use standards and how those might or might not be applied as ARARs. Tribes, as you may know, have the ability under other statutes to set air and water quality standards that can be approved by EPA and used as ARARs. So the real contention arose around soil standards, for which there is no similar ability. The tribes had difficulty understanding why that should be. It was, you know, they certainly wanted the ability to set their own soil standards and have those be recognized by EPA. Similarly, if they had a land use plan, they wanted that land use plan to be accepted by EPA as an ARAR for the purposes of determining reasonable future land use. And that wasn't always happening, particularly in the case where residential activities were impinging on industrial sites like mining sites. Okay, moving on to slide 16. So basically, cleanup standards were a huge issue, particularly for soil and waste materials. And in some cases, we just had really, really huge volumes of these materials, and as I said, many risks associated with them. I think I spoke about most of these issues before, so let's move on to slide 17. On top of all of these very complex and difficult substantive issues, there are also a lot of unique process issues associated with tribal sites. And this is where some of the mediator challenges really come in. So in slide 18 are listed some of the issues that were brought up both by EPA and the tribes. And consultation was a huge issue. The ability of tribes to be consulted during any federal process, but the manner in which people really didn't know how to do that effectively as part of the Superfund process, or really almost any process. Communication issues were significant. Jurisdictional conflicts, you know, I mentioned some of those earlier. The tribes would have liked to have a lot more control over their own lands, and sometimes EPA didn't feel like it could give that control up. And inconsistent application of the law and policy throughout the country. We saw some very different applications of, you know, what people truly believed were the right way to do these things. So moving on to slide 19, probably the biggest issue is consultation. And at the time, there was really very little guidance about consultation. Since then, President Obama has released a new consultation document, but it's still quite vague. And it's unclear really how to implement it. What does it really look like in practice? You know, what exactly does one do to ensure that appropriate consultation is carried out? And who really makes the decisions? Among the sites we looked at, there was a huge range of decision-making processes, everything from EPA soliciting opinions and then making its own decision, considered consultation, to some kind of shared facilitated process, to EPA giving the tribes the right to concur on a ROD and not feeling that it could proceed without that concurrence. So everything, the complete gamut of ways of dealing with concurrence. And in each case, that particular site manager or region felt that they were following Superfund policy and guidance. So there was clearly some need for maybe more consistency and more direction. On top of consultation is tribal trust responsibilities and treaty rights. And a lot of people don't realize that those are really two separate things. So the federal government has a trust responsibility to the tribes, and this comes into play in terms of the tribes' expectation that EPA will protect their lands, protect their uses of the land, protect their people. And that goes over and above the consultation requirement. In addition, each tribe has a different treaty with the United States government and sometimes with state governments. And these treaties can lay out additional treaty rights that may be unique to each tribe or region. And sometimes those come into play. For example, the Bolt decision in Washington State, which gave tribes the right to 50% of the fish and shellfish collected in the state, has had substantial impacts on Superfund cleanups in Washington State. Other things that affected the relationship between the parties, there were some significant cultural missteps in the processes that we investigated. For example, a tendency to see facilitated processes or review processes as consultation without explicitly setting that up ahead of time and obtain an agreement from the tribe that that process was sufficient. In many cases, the tribe did not feel that was sufficient. Also, we had cases in which tribal liaisons weren't really aware of the cultural processes or the governmental processes of the tribes in which they were dealing with and made significant errors in that respect. There are always issues with sacred information, such as the types of herbs or plants that are used as medicine, the types of areas that are considered sacred. That isn't always information that the tribes want to reveal, but it's still a cultural practice that they want to protect. So that's an interesting area where both the tribes and the EPA have to be very creative in how they work together in order to protect those resources without forcing essentially information to be revealed, because that in itself is kind of a violation. Communication issues often reflected different communication styles and a tendency for the Superfund process to devalue tribal knowledge of the land, oral histories, different ways of knowing, and the knowledge that tribal elders and tribal people have that isn't necessarily written down or scientifically documented in the way that the EPA Superfund process is used to seeing it. Other issues were tribal government and decision processes. Every tribe has a different form of government, and their decision processes are all often very different from that which EPA is used to using. And that is very important to assess and address ahead of time. Often tribes felt they were not being given sufficient time to review large and complex documents, particularly when the need to go back to the tribal council and obtain approval for responses to those documents was factored in. Slide 20. One of the biggest issues that came up with consultation, I mentioned consultation versus facilitation before. EPA has been setting up more and more facilitated processes as part of its Superfund sites, and this is generally viewed as a good thing. But when you add the fact that tribes have the right and the ability to have separate consultation processes with federal governments, and they really prefer to do that without all the other parties present for pretty obvious reasons, I think. So you have, on the one hand, often you have facilitation and consultation processes going on simultaneously but separately. That presents a real challenge to the mediator. First of all, he or she may not even know what's going on in the consultation process, may not be included in that process. And then there's the need to really communicate with the other parties and help them understand what consultation is, why there's that special relationship between the tribes and the federal government, and figure out a way to work those parallel processes. They may not work well together. Sometimes you just can't make it work, but it's important to explicitly consider it. And one of the reasons that tribes exercise their consultation authorities is that, as we heard in this study from all sides, they often are able to achieve their goals more effectively through consultation than through a facilitated process where more parties' interests are involved. So it's important for them to continue to have that option and to exercise it. But sometimes other parties see that as a breach of trust or a breach of the process rules. So that requires the management of their expectations by the mediator. Moving on to slide 21. Really, a big issue has to do with just the kinds of feelings that people bring into a mediation process, which is often very different from a typical mediation process. There is a lot of historical context between the federal government and the tribes. It's just impossible to ignore anyone who walks into one of these processes thinking that history is not going to be present is very wrong. It comes up typically at every mediation session, in every meeting, and room needs to be made for it. Excuse me. So, you know, tribes have a long memory, and rightly so. There have been a lot of historic injustices by the federal government, and so there are significant trust issues and significant relationship building and trust occur in each project. This can lead to a lot of anger and frustration coming into these processes that is often vented at the EPA staff person who may not understand why he or she is receiving this anger and frustration and distrust, who may not feel like he or she has earned that personally. So one of the most important messages we try to provide to EPA staff is don't take it personally. Understand the history. Give time for that history to be presented in your process and really try to understand what's happening there so that you don't feel like it's being, you know, directed at you personally. That can be very hard. There is a sense by the tribes that the regulators are treating this more like a job. It is a job for us. We often have many different jobs in our careers, and we work on many different sites, many different projects. For them, it's their home, it's their reservation, it's their earth, it's their spirituality, it's the land they will always be on for generations to come. So they have a different sense of investment in that site than any of the people working on it. So that tension needs to be acknowledged. And often they feel like they get close to agreement, close to getting to know people, and then those staff change. So to the extent that staff changes can be minimized on these projects, that's helpful. Moving on to slide 22. We often found that there were community contexts that were more challenging than in normal Superfund sites as well. There were significant trust issues between PRPs and the tribes. Often the PRPs have been allowed to operate on tribal land by entities other than the tribes, for example, by the BIA or some other federal agency that had allowed that PRP to operate on tribal lands, or sometimes by a tribal council member or a tribal council that really didn't always represent the villages or the people. Tribal councils in some tribes didn't really exist until the federal government had a need for them to exist so that they could have someone to deal with. So there is sometimes a difference in needs and goals between tribal councils and local tribal communities, particularly on the largest reservations or on reservations where different tribes and bands have been combined. Frequently, the tribes have a strong distrust of the PRP because of past experiences with that PRP. Sometimes they have nothing to do with Superfund. They might be other permitting processes. They might be, you know, land access issues, basically things like that. A perception that the federal government is not enforcing regulations on the reservation to the same degree that they would be off the reservation. So there are big issues there, and one of those issues is the Superfund allows the PRP to conduct the investigation, conduct the cleanup, or essentially requires the PRP to do that in most cases. And that's the last person that most tribes really want to have doing that work. They would prefer, in general, we heard that they would prefer EPA to be doing that work or even for the tribe to be doing that work if the tribe is well-funded enough or if the tribe can obtain funding to do that. And then there were some issues with surrounding communities. We were a little surprised to find the extent of racial prejudice that still exists in many cases. There were economic and development issues. Sometimes the tribes were in favor of NPL listing and the surrounding communities were not because of impacts on business. To the extent that sometimes they could convince governors not to support the NPL listing. They just really had different priorities sometimes and deep mistrust. And then there are also internal issues in politics within tribes, as well as there were some cases where the BIA was involved, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that usually complicated matters and not in a positive way. So to the extent that tribes can be allowed to represent themselves as opposed to having the BIA come in, that's generally a positive thing. And to the extent that the local tribal communities most impacted by the waste site can also have a voice in the process, those were the most successful processes. Which leads us to slide 23 and any questions that anyone might have about this long discussion of substantive issues.
We're feeling any questions. Does anyone have any just comments or thoughts or like to share any of the experiences they have that might be kind of reflected in this kind of work?
So quiet. Okay. Well, I guess, Anna, I'll turn it back to you to discuss the results of the process of the study.
We're breezing right along here. We'll move on to slide 24. So we've looked at the goals of using an ADR process. Oh, we do have a question that just came in. Why don't we pull this up while Teresa's still on? How did you handle the conflict between facilitating and consulting? Was there a reflection of that in the interviews that you did, Teresa?
How did I handle the conflict?
How was the conflict handled?
Can the person get on the phone and clarify the question?
I guess that'll depend on if they're on the phone or not.
Hey, this is Mike, the moderator here. I think if you go back a couple slides when you talked about I guess this is probably slide 20.
Oh, you're talking about facilitation and consultation.
Yeah, I think the context is coming from as if it's a single mediator that has to provide both of those services.
Yeah, okay. So this has to just be based on my experience. So what does the mediator do when the tribes prefer or circumvent the mediation process? And in my experience and in the experience of the other mediators that were interviewed in this process, the tribes generally participated in the facilitated process as well as exercised their right to consultation. And the consultation process that the tribe set up with the federal government sometimes included the facilitator and sometimes didn't. So that was really just their preference, you know, on how they wanted to have that discussion with, you know, kind of face-to-face at a high level or with more participants, you know, and a facilitator and kind of a lot of preparation. So every process is different. There were cases where, you know, really ideally the mediator should do some education with the remaining parties to help them understand why the consultation is occurring, why it's appropriate, and if the tribes are willing to reveal to the mediator what issues are being addressed, then the mediator can help the group understand what's occurring. My own personal recommendation is to be as upfront about that as possible and simply, you know, make it clear that this is something they have the right to do. These are the reasons that they're doing it. And if they want to express their reasons in the facilitated session, they're welcome to do that. And then treat the consultation as something that kind of supersedes the facilitated process. If the tribe reaches agreement with the federal government on an issue through consultation, legally speaking, that supersedes any facilitated process. So then that decision would need to be brought back into the facilitated process as a given, essentially. So it does require some sensitivity to manage, but I think it can work. I have seen cases where it doesn't work. For example, if those discussions are held essentially without any information being given to anyone else and people begin to resent that, then the facilitated process may be negatively affected by it. However, the tribes may still get what they need, you know. It all depends on whose goals you're trying to meet, whether you think that process is working or not. Does that clarify the question? Hopefully.
Thanks, Teresa. Were there any other questions while we are paused here? All right. Moving on to slide 24. So we've looked at the goals for using ADR process on superfund sites, and we've looked at some of the issues that arise during these interactions. Oh, we got a little bit of a delay. Actually, another question just came through. The previous question says yes, thanks, that answered the question. And then also we have a new question on the issue of BIA. Do mediators have to do any mediation work between the agencies as well as with the tribes?
Yeah, let me see if I can answer that. I hate to say it, but generally when the BIA was involved, the general feeling was that they didn't add much to the process. It's not that they had different goals or how should I put this, actively caused any issues or problems. It's that they were an unnecessary layer between the tribe and the rest of the parties. And when the tribe in that case, in two cases actually, decided to just participate more actively and directly rather than having the BIA there, the facilitation process went a lot more smoothly. Because the BIA was not effectively representing the tribe's issues and concerns. So, but there certainly have been a number of these sites where the mediator has to do work between the agencies that's separate from the tribes. There are often cases where the agencies have conflicting goals and conflicting opinions. This is one reason we focused on Superfund processes rather than NRDA processes, because NRDA processes involve a large number of agencies typically, and sometimes a number of different tribes. And those are far more complex. We thought we would just start with Superfund where there's really one main agency and maybe tackle NRDA later.
Great, thank you again. All right, I'll go one more try to towards Sly 24. So let's take a look at what some of the results were of these processes. Now that we've gone through kind of what some of the reasons for starting them up were and what were some of the issues that people wanted to resolve. Slide 25. We found that mediators were most helpful when they did a series of these events here, or actions, when they managed negative behaviors in meetings. For example, mediators set and enforced ground rules about communication and respect. They modeled good behavior and mitigated the effect of strong personalities or willful non-participation as a means to be disruptive. In this way, they also brought structure to the process and really kind of rules of order in setting a framework for how people interacted with one another. They demonstrated empathy and neutrality, maintaining a calm and respectful demeanor throughout heated discussions. And that's part of the benefit of them being a neutral and not having a clear stake in it other than to see that the process goes well and that people are heard. They helped parties move beyond the past. They used flexible approaches as called for and adapted to specific situations as they arose, rather than sticking to a rote process map. They were able to really adapt to the circumstances. They worked with parties to build and maintain commitment to the process, and broadly they promoted healing and trust building. Successful mediators understood and used the proper lines of communication. They took the effort to schedule some meetings and reservations, arranged cultural events so that all parties could understand where the other party is coming from in terms of cultural background, and educated participants on issues of sovereignty, government-to-government relationships, and Indian law. In addition to that, as Teresa mentioned before, an important aspect was the mediator's ability to have tribal community members' voices be heard as distinct from tribal government's representation, which is also very important. Sometimes that involves getting translation services or providing space for members that maybe do not have elected office. Mediators' knowledge of both tribal and cultural law, as well as the Superfund process, was especially appreciated, really serving as that translator between tribal culture and the legal issues there, and the Superfund process and the complications and the technical side that the EPA is dealing with, and being able to serve as a go-between in order to explain those processes to the other party in a clear way. In some cases, the mediators also worked out strategies to reach out to the community that's not at the table, such as the business community or the state legislature. And they did this especially when they knew the support of those parties would ultimately be necessary to implement final agreement. Slide 26. The ADR process resulted in improved communication, with participants able to share information more constructively. They were better able to understand each other and the issues that were most relevant. They were able to develop a more positive relationship. All sides were able to build greater mutual respect and support through this process, and really just having an ability to sit down in one place and get to know each other and get to know those issues and learn a lot about some of the underpinning things that were going on in the situation. Especially individuals from the tribe reported feeling truly heard for the first time. There were some processes that were able to draw in a greater variety of stakeholders to the discussion, and EPA reported developing a better understanding of those concerns due to those various voices being effectively represented. In one case, the PRP began working effectively with the other participants and began conducting activities voluntarily because they were able to understand kind of the core of what was happening, and they were willing to take some extra steps to resolve some issues. There were also cases where the mediated process helped the agencies and tribes work more effectively with local and state governments because there, too, relationships had been built and collaboration could ensue. These successes really helped improve trust and made the parties feel more optimistic about successfully working together in the future. And that's one of the fundamentally good things about an ADR process, is that it's not just reaching agreement on the substantive issues or the specific reasons that brought you to the table, but in addition to that, it's building those relationships and building those lines of communication so that people can go forward and interact more positively. The parties also reported reaching substantive agreements that they may not have been able to reach otherwise. and that due to the improved relationships, alternative dispute resolution could eventually be phased out. Basically, once the group had begun functioning well on its own, it knew the framework and how people should communicate with each other, trust and relationships and friendships even had been built. They were able to continue on their own in a much better capacity. Slide 27. Some concerns were also expressed related to the AAR process. It didn't 100% of the time create 100% positive results. Some felt that the time and financial cost of the process was a really high barrier to entry, and people were hesitant to even start down that road because of those, especially when there was a resistance or lack of support for AAR from their management, and that's from the internal EPA side, right? Even though participants recognized that a lack of agreement could have drawn out the process even more or prevented a solution from being found, they were still concerned with the amount of the time the process took up front. Some processes may have looked for short-term wins or sought to achieve objectives that were separate from long-term relationship trust issues that involved overall conflict. And so they maybe didn't address those longer-term issues that were likely to arise again and again and therefore not have the positive impact of future ability to work together in a more productive way. Participants also reflected that the process did not last long enough in some cases for parties to internalize new communication skills and establish enough of a positive relationship to last far into the future. So they were able to get kind of a sense of where they should go and how they should get there, but they weren't really able to practice and get the skills down so that they can make sure it would happen without the assistance of a neutral. In some cases, the mediated process was not able to resolve the issues or improve relationships. And they reported that this in general attributed to the parties themselves not being flexible on what they came to the table with. They were not willing to budge from their preconceived positions. So when this happens, parties kind of got locked into what they wanted in very specific terms and weren't able to go through that process of sharing interests and understanding the other party. When this happened, those parties reasonably tended to feel that it was a waste of time and money to go through that process. And that really goes to needing to understand better what those processes are and whether or not that's the right tool to achieve the goal that you're looking for as a party. Slide 28. Now I'll switch it back to Teresa.
And I think I'm first going to comment on just a couple of things on slide 27, too, just relative to these fixed positions. You know, normally in mediation, we encourage people not to have fixed positions, to really negotiate and be open-minded about things. But some of the things that we talked about earlier in this presentation, we have to be particularly cognizant that in Superfund and tribal issues, both sides may have positions that are legitimately fixed. And the key is really looking at that ahead of time. We need to not assume, as mediators, we tend to, you know, really be positive about the mediation process, really feel that it has benefits in every case. But the more those of us who are senior mediators have worked on these projects, we're beginning to realize that some of these projects hold particular risks and particular trust issues. And we need to be very careful to identify these significant fixed positions before we start and make sure that the issues really can be mediated. And I'll also say that the most successful processes I've seen between tribes and agencies have lasted a really long time. It can take 2 or 3 years for the parties to really begin to understand each other, and that sounds like way too long for most people. But I have seen 5-year processes that really got to very good places in the end, and it just takes that long for us to bridge this particular cultural gap, and that's a major issue for this type of mediated process. So with that, I'll just stop for a minute and see if there are any questions. I think this might, we're well ahead of schedule, so are there any questions or comments at this point? I'm not hearing any, but if you...
And for those of you on the phone lines, remember to unmute your phone. You can hit #6 right now to unmute your phone and ask a question.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, the whole point of this study was to obtain some recommendations other than just learning about what it's like to do Superfund processes on tribal lands and the extent to which mediation can assist with those processes. What are the recommendations that we heard from everyone involved? I'm moving to slide 29. I guess, as I was just mentioning, there's something in mediation called a situation assessment that you do before you even start. And frequently, we're not given a lot of time to do that, or we're not allowed to do it at all. It's expected to kind of walk into a situation and start mediating. But in these particular cases, we found that a strong situation assessment was absolutely critical to the success of the project. Many of the projects that failed had not done a situation assessment. Many of the projects that succeeded beyond everyone's wildest expectations had situation assessments that went well above and beyond the standard situation assessment. So if you look at this slide, the first two bullets basically is identifying the issues and whether they're ready to be mediated and assessing people's willingness to work together. That's a standard situation assessment. And this is where you try to find out if people have fixed positions, if they're really ready to negotiate. But the next three are really, I think, critical based on what we learned in this process to a good situation assessment for any process that involves both agencies and tribes. And that is the mediator needs to understand the tribe's specific history and cultural background. Mediator needs to know that before they walk into the room. And that takes time. That involves meeting with tribal members, visiting the reservation, preferably, you know, reading materials, learning as much as possible about that tribe's government and history. And then, you know, really designing a customized process. The only negative feedback we received about a mediator had to do with one who came in with a cookie-cutter process that he'd used on, you know, many different sites and expected it to work in this case, and it didn't. So I think for most of these sites, you need to design a customized process that takes into account the particular parties and situation that exist, and that takes a little more time. And the other thing is there are likely to be these long-standing historical trust and adversarial issues. And working with those before the process starts can be really, really helpful. A couple of the mediators did this in our case studies, and they had the best processes because their parties were best prepared. They had let go of some of their emotional, you know, attachments to the past and were ready to really work together, and that was important. Other recommendations that came out were to make sure that all the parties involved, especially the tribes, were involved in selection of the mediator so that that person was not only perceived to be but actually was neutral or really was trusted by the tribes to, you know, really represent everyone's interests equally. And that is not always the case. Sometimes EPA uses its contracting mechanisms to just, you know, select a party, particularly if they're in a hurry. But more and more lately, I'm seeing that EPA recognizes the importance of this and is involving the local communities and the tribes in selecting the practitioner. And then making sure you get one who has experience with, you know, cultural issues, with tribal issues, and or a co-mediator, a native practitioner that can participate. In a couple of these cases, we had co-mediators, one from a, you know, traditional Western background and another, a native mediator. But it's important that the practitioner understands both Superfund and the tribal cultures that they're working with as best they can. Moving on to slide 30. From a more national level, a lot of issues came up, consultation being the biggest of those. The national guidance is still vague, the new guidance notwithstanding. And we heard from many people that even where the regional offices had MOAs with tribes, they were frequently not followed. And there's a recognition that the process needs to be cultured to each tribal government, that you can't just have one process that applies to everyone, because each one is an individual government. So more generally then, how would you approach this? And our recommendations were to, first of all, really ensure that the goals of consultation are clear. Often people kind of go into consultation without any real sense of what they're hoping to achieve. They just want to talk to each other about an issue. And that's okay, but it may not provide as much end result as really knowing what you're trying to accomplish with that consultation. What is the beginning? What is the end? What is the purpose? Ensuring that proper protocol is followed. We had a couple of consultation processes that got completely derailed at the last minute because of someone's rules or regulations that just didn't fit into the cultural practice of the tribe. And, you know, no one showed up, so that didn't work. Bringing the right level of participants together. So the government-to-government relationship, and so it's important to make sure that the same level of participants are present on both sides. If you have a tribal council member present, then at least the regional administrator needs to be present. Understanding that tribal councils have incredible numbers of things to address. This is only one of, you know, an entire government that they're running. So it's important to make really effective use of their time. And that typically involves a lot of preparation, a lot of pre-work with staff to make sure that everyone's really ready for the consultation when it occurs. And the obvious things, defining the ground rules, structuring the discussion, and most importantly, actually carrying out the follow-up actions. Sometimes we have these big consultation processes, things are agreed to, and then they're not carried out. And that just adds to the distrust and the problems between the sides. So one question a lot of the facilitators asked was, you know, is facilitation even relevant to the consultation process? And the answer is a resounding maybe. Sometimes, sometimes not, and it just depends on what the tribe wants to do and how they want to do it. Sometimes they're just more comfortable going right in and talking directly face-to-face, council chair with regional administrator. And sometimes it's helpful to have staff on both sides, presenting issues, getting resolution, having a facilitated process. So it really all depends on the situation. A facilitator should not expect to always be involved in that. Other national recommendations, there really needs to be some explanation of what tribal trust responsibilities are in the context of Superfund. I haven't met a single person who understands that fully. Tribal members know what they mean by tribal trust responsibilities, but almost no one in the agency does. And so it's partly because there's nothing that explains it. There's nothing written down often. When you ask what it is or what is needed, there's an expectation by the tribe that the federal government should know that. And so it's often difficult for an individual site manager to ascertain what exactly they're expected to do to meet those trust responsibilities and whether they can legally do it within the Superfund framework. So that could really use some explanation and guidance. Also addressing some of the legal issues that came up that we discussed, for example, whether it would be possible for tribes to develop soil standards and land use guidelines and have them be treated as ARERs in the Superfund process. Having some more national risk assessment guidance that makes it clear that tribal scenarios and exposure parameters and land uses can be included in risk assessments. And some examples of how to do that. And that, I think, is under development. Also, people recommended reauthorization of the Superfund tax so that more expensive cleanups could be accommodated. And some other fine legal details, which I won't go into. moving on to slide 31. At the regional level, there was just a sense that, you know, and regions have really tried. They have really worked on this issue in the last 10 or 20 years of developing a more inclusive culture, particularly with respect to tribes and environmental justice issues. But there still is a need for training on tribal law, tribal treaties, tribal trust responsibilities, all of those issues that we've been talking about, and hiring tribal members. In some of the regions with the most tribes, there is not a single tribal member in the region. And some of the site managers expressed the thought that it would be helpful to have such a person that they could go to and ask questions when they don't understand what a tribe wants or why they want it, to really go to someone and get a perspective, you know, on that. Also to just be more flexible and responsive to the tribe's needs, rather than kind of meeting the spirit of what the tribes need rather than the letter of what is required, because as you can see, these two things don't fit real well together. The Superfund framework just doesn't fit that well in tribal lands, and so there's a need to be flexible. And it's not always the case that agencies are designed to be flexible for some good reason. So that's an issue that needs to be addressed. Site managers, just like for mediators, it was recommended that site managers spend some time when they get a new project on a reservation to really understand that tribe's government, that tribe's history, that tribe's culture, before they really start working with the tribe, to avoid missteps, to, you know, just to better understand what the tribe is asking for and why, and just, you know, if possible, to visit the reservation, to meet with the staff, to see the areas with their own eyes, you know, kids playing in waste piles, things like that. Be sure, again, that you seek parity in government-to-government relationships. Most EPA staff and EPA regions are doing their best to provide financial resources for tribes and environmental justice communities to participate. We didn't actually find in this study that tribes were having difficulty in that respect. Some of them were better funded than their neighbors. And we're willing to take on more work, but weren't being given the opportunity. I mean, just listen and be open-minded and don't take things personally, as I mentioned before, because it probably isn't personal. Slide 33, other recommendations for site managers. More so than on a typical site, work at taking a longer-term view of protecting human health and the environment because of the issues discussed earlier, because this is a limited land resource for this group. It's important to the tribe to have all of that resource available for their members to use to practice their cultural and spiritual practices. And because the tribes tend to live off the land more than we do, and because they're always going to live in that place, it's very important to try and take that view and to understand that view, even though it's difficult. I've worked with tribes for 20 years, and I still know that I am not able to put myself in that mindset. So I do my very best, but we just have to know what we know and know what we don't know and be willing to listen. Because of the consultation requirements and trust responsibilities, try to emphasize teamwork a little more when working with a tribe, or a lot more, as opposed to the sort of traditional, you know, being in charge and making all the decisions and gathering input from stakeholders. Tribes are not stakeholders. They're governments, and it's important to treat them as such. If possible, most tribes want to participate in the work. They would like to participate in sampling design, in the actual sampling, sometimes in the construction work, in the long-term monitoring. That's something that doesn't fit into the normal Superfund paradigm, but it's important in terms of their own control of their land and also the ability to provide training and jobs for their tribal members. So to the extent that's possible, it's helpful. And we did have also a number of recommendations for mediators, which I won't go through because I know most of you aren't mediators. But many of them were similar to the recommendations for the site managers. Let's see. We've got one question. I'm not sure I understand tribal trust responsibilities. Can you clarify what these are and how they are established? You and everyone else. So, this is difficult. Consultation is established as the right for a tribe to be consulted by a federal agency when the federal agency takes an action. Tribal trust is kind of over and beyond that. It's because of the tribe's status as a dependent sovereign nation to the United States. So they are sovereign nations, but they're also dependent to the United States. And therefore, the United States has certain responsibilities to the tribes. The tribes, just like it's, you know, I shouldn't say like a state because they're not like a state, but the tribes have certain regulatory authorities, and the federal government has retained other regulatory authorities with respect to reservation lands. With those authorities come responsibilities. So that's where tribal trust responsibility comes from. I'm not an expert in Indian law, so if there's someone else that wants to comment on that, if there's a tribal member here that would like to present their view of that, that would be great. But that's my understanding of how it's separate from consultation, and it's also separate from specific treaty rights that are laid out in individual treaties. Any other questions and comments right now? Okay. Let's see. Since we have a bit of time, can you tell us about the recommendations for mediators? I sure can. Give me a second to get into that part of the report since we don't have it on the slides.
While she's doing that, let me take a moment here. If you go to slide 38, we have, in addition, we want you to provide the participants to provide feedback. We have a feedback form link there. But the reason why I bring this up is the under the there's a link to additional resources, and under those additional resources, we do have a quick link to the document that the presenters are talking about today.
Yeah, and there's a lot more information in the document than I'm able to cover here. Recommendations for mediators. The first recommendation was to have strong intercultural skills and good rapport with agencies and scientists, engineers, as well as having lots of experience working with Indian tribes. And that's a tall order, but it's really important for this type of process that ability can make or break one of these processes. So if an individual mediator doesn't have it, then all of those things, then it's helpful to have a co-mediator. Again, it was felt that it was critical for mediators to conduct a thorough situation assessment. And that's where we as mediators need to push back on hiring processes that don't give us sufficient time to do that. Part of the reason we wrote this report was to help convening agencies understand this issue. Sometimes we hear that situation assessments really aren't necessary, we don't have time, we don't have the money for that, they're just a report we stick on a shelf. This is to help understand why they're so critical, or at least in what kinds of projects are they critical. In some cases, we can just walk in and mediate a meeting. That's no big deal. So we need to start pushing back on that. We need to say, hey, this is a process where you need a situation assessment. You need to give us sufficient time to do it. Pre-meetings with the parties. This is something that came up a number of times. Both EPA and tribal members sometimes had expectations of the mediator or the process that were unrealistic or weren't really appropriate for ADR. For example, we often have requests by site managers to help us gain buy-in from the public or from tribes, and that's not really a typical ADR function because it doesn't involve negotiation or discussion or mediation. It's a different kind of process. Or, you know, tribes may feel that we're there to advocate for them, or EPA may feel that we're there to advocate for them, and that's not our function. Also, there's sometimes a need to understand that the parties are equal in these processes, and parties don't always go in feeling equal. If one or the other of the parties feels that they hold the decision authority and can't give it up, then there may need to be some discussion around that before the process starts, so that either EPA or the mediator needs to clearly understand what those boundaries are and can communicate them to the rest of the parties. Other recommendations were very, very similar, such as, you know, doing your research, getting to know the tribe, being willing to listen, be humble, learn, know what you don't know, spend time on the reservation, understand the government, and how the decisions are going to be made at the tribe. Being aware of the history between the federal government and the tribes, don't always expect agreement. That's a hard one for mediators. These are really, really tough cases, and for us to go in expecting agreement may be unrealistic. Maybe all we can expect is an improvement in understanding or an improvement in relationships or an improvement in communication, and that may be a big benefit, but it may not ultimately lead to agreement. We may clarify through our improved communication process that the two sides can't agree and need to go to consultation or litigation or some other form of discussion. Again, be patient, don't take things personally, avoid over-identification with either side. There were some issues about neutrality. EPA and the typical Western mediation process expects neutrality from mediators. This is not the case in all cultures. In some Asian cultures, as well as some tribal cultures, the mediating party is not necessarily neutral. And so we had some pushback from the native practitioners that maybe it wasn't always appropriate for that party or necessary for that party to be neutral in order to gain improved trust between the sides and to gain agreement between the sides. Particularly where there were local communities who hadn't been represented at all and were counting on that mediator who maybe spoke their language when no one else did to represent their position. So that was a very interesting facet of this for us, anyway, as practitioners. So I've probably spoken too much about that, but those were the recommendations for mediators. Any other questions? Okay, well, if you think of any, chime in or type away, and meanwhile, I'll turn it back over to Anna.
All right, well, we are quite a bit ahead of schedule. Breezed through some of the initial stuff and expected more questions. So please, if you do have any questions, please type in or chime in. And really, the last thing here is just wanting to engage you all in thinking about next steps and for the EPA, what kind of tools, resources are needed for us to improve in our working relationships or in our understandings of how to deal with tribes. And I think some clear recommendations have come out of this report, including some of the recommendations you were just talking about in terms of getting clear on tribal trust responsibilities and just educating people about what that means. And does anyone have any ideas? Kind of how do we move this dialogue forward? How do we find the right tools or make the right changes to improve our operations? Any thoughts out there?
Anna?
Yep.
This is Sean in Region 7.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm fine. This was a great presentation today. I guess my question was, as a coordinator for ECR and ADR processes here, I certainly feel like there's more that I could do. I just wanted to add that in that, you know, if you all have any thoughts about what we could do region by region, if nothing else, to communicate some of these concepts over and over, to the programs and others. So that's something I'd be certainly willing to be a part of. So just sharing my thoughts, you know, there's definitely more that can be done, and I'd be willing to help out.
Great. Thank you, Sean. I will be in touch with you about that.
Yeah, I think we can just maybe give some quick ideas here since we have time. Yeah, I think one of the issues is the convening process. We often hear from regions that that's not part of the process they want to pay for or fund. And so as a coordinator for ADR, it could be really helpful for you to really, you know, have that in your back pocket as something that's important for specific types of sites and be able to articulate why that is. And also to know what sources of funding there might be outside of the region, like CPRC, or the U.S. Institute for Environmental Conflict Resolution. And there are other sources of funding that might be willing to cover part of, you know, to cover the convening process, or the assessment, situation assessment, prior to the actual ADR, start of the ADR process. So that would be one thing. The other thing might be for regions to really work with the tribes in their region to develop consultation practices, expectations around that, and talk with them about how that fits into facilitated processes so that when you get a site, you kind of know what the tribe's expectation is for working with the region. Those would be my, you know, sort of suggestions for where to get started.
That's a great point, Teresa. And as you mentioned before, not only the White House did come out with a policy on consultation that was a bit more clear after the assessment was already done, but EPA also came out with its specific consultation guidance for the agency. And from that, different regions are coming up with their own consultation policies. And I think those are all still in the works. So to the extent that we can encourage them to interact with the tribes where issues are negotiable or even just to inform the process, I think that's a great thing to advocate for.
And yeah, hopefully they're not doing that in a vacuum.
Hopefully. Well, and then also what comes to my mind is kind of almost like tools or work aids for individuals working within EPA that are dealing in the tribal context. So if they know kind of the clear lines of communication based on what people who have worked with that tribe before have already learned, and that there's a transfer of knowledge there. I think sometimes, yeah, you know, one person works with the tribe for 5 years and gets to know them very well and understands how the processes work, and then they get transferred or go in detail or move in some capacity, and another person comes in and starts from scratch where if there's some transition documents, there might be kind of more hit the ground running in terms of understanding how to appropriately approach the tribe.
That's very frustrating for the tribes, and I've heard that over and over, that, you know, they're there for 30 years or for 6 years, and people in the agencies keep changing, and they keep having to re-educate those folks. So any way that continuity can be provided would be great. The other thing that I just thought of just now would be, you know, technical tools. I know that some tribes are developing their own guidance for risk assessment, so what their specific exposure scenarios are, what their consumption rates are, what their cultural practices are, to the extent that you can work with your tribes to understand and incorporate those or develop those jointly so that when a site comes up, it's, you know, that information is already there. I mean, this is obviously more the case for tribes with large reservations or multiple sites, but, you know, it could still be useful.
Hello, my name's Patty. I'm a tribal project manager, and I think one of the challenges that we see in terms of the EPA structure is there's very few site managers that are trained to do that work. So often folks get appointed to sites that really don't want to work with tribes, or there's just no flexibility because there isn't enough site managers to handle all these sites, especially in our region. So we just see a real need there to have more site managers trained up.
Yeah, I think that's really true in some regions especially, and others are, you know, like regions 9 and 10, for example, have so many tribes that it's more likely that you'll get someone who has a long history of working with your tribe or other tribes in the region, but there are many regions who infrequently encounter the issue. And I think, you know, if you have that kind of problem with an individual, that's where, if that region has a tribal liaison that you can work with, or even start a consultation process, you know, let the regional administrator know that this is important to you. And
Patty,
that would be my suggestion. Or ask for a facilitator.
Sorry to interrupt you, Teresa. Patty, I have a follow-up question. Do you think, you mentioned training, and I think that's really important, but I'm wondering if, from your perspective, kind of a general, like, training that could be applied nationwide on working with tribes writ large would be effective, or is it really more specific context in your region?
No, I think the national, a national training initiative is really necessary, because I just could identify with all the issues and challenges that were brought up during this training. I think they're very common amongst all, many sites anyway. It is for ours too. So I just think this is really a national problem, not just a regional problem.
And to that, I would add that I think somebody said earlier, repeat it and repeat it and repeat it.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt to have both national and state, you know, or regional training. I know we have state training here in Washington State, because every site involves tribes, usually more than one. And the training is taught by the tribes themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us a real sense of the history of involvement of the state with the tribes and the specific treaties that the tribes have with our state, that is really useful. So it kind of depends on the context, I think. A national training would be super helpful, especially for site managers who don't encounter it very often, and in regions for which there might not be the resources to have a special, you know, tribal training because they don't encounter tribal sites that often. We certainly found regions that had not had any sites like this, particularly in the east and the south, southeast.
Well, and I think there's another issue, too, about, you know, there just isn't enough site managers to go around in our region, and I'm not sure why that is, but I think it's really been a challenge here, because, you know, I think there's other EPA people who could do this work, but they have to be trained as site manager for whatever reason. So it's just, there's just not a pool of people to choose from.
Yeah, that's the truth. I didn't mention it, but there was a definite sentiment among many of the tribal members I talked about that this was not moving fast enough, that they had tribal members that were injured, that were dying, resources that were being lost, you know, generations of people being affected while this process was dragging on, and some way to get that message across more effectively, you know, was needed, that urgency was important, that more urgency needs to be given to these sites where people are living right on top of uranium mines and things like that.
Teresa, I do have another comment from the text submissions. It's actually, to me, it asks if I've considered early on dialogue before problems arise to reduce the burden on tribes and get folks on the same page. And I think that's something that's really important with any situation. I mean, conflict prevention is what's the saying, and ounce of prevention is worth a larger amount of the cure. I'm going to fail in my cliches. But the problem is, or the difficulty is that it's hard to find those, you know, right before they become a conflict situations. And one of the things that our office does, in addition to providing mediators, facilitators to go in and do that work, is we do provide training on negotiation skills, communication skills, working with difficult people skills, to try to provide your average EPA staff member with more resources and tools in their toolbox to be able to go into a situation and be able to help improve communications and prevent things from going down a path towards problems in that context. And I think that speaks to Patty's comment on training and a national training being needed. And I know EPA does have a training on government-to-government and tribal relations. But I have been talking with some individuals that work specifically with the Superfund program and work on training programs for Superfund staff. And I'll continue those dialogues to see if we can develop a more tailored Superfund-specific tribal relations training that hits kind of some of the specifics of that particular context.
Yeah, I think that would be important because of the really specific issues that are coming up here. Yeah, I was amazed at how similar a lot of these sites were and how similar the issues were.
Are there any other thoughts or comments? Well, as Michael mentioned, the entire report is available on the main or on the additional resources page. I've also provided on slide 36 a link to the intranet. So if you're internal to EPA, you can click on that, and there's a PDF of the Superfund on Tribal Lands report there as well. Or if you'd like a PDF version of your own, I think you can download it off of the CLUIN website. But in addition, I've provided there my email address, abby.anna@epa.gov. Feel free to contact me, or I imagine also Teresa would be available if you have any questions about the report. And also, if you do work with EPA and you are interested in learning more about mediation and facilitation services, please give me a call or send me an email. I'd be happy to talk to you more about what our office does and talk through some options with you and try to pinpoint whether or not it's the service that would be helpful in the situation you're working with, or, you know, give you helpful hints or guide you to other resources that might be able to help you through a rough patch if that's what you need. So with that, are there – yes?
This is Richard DeBay calling from Region 10.
Hi, Richard.
I just wanted to address a couple of points that were raised earlier. First, there was a question about whether tribal laws or ordinances could be ARARs for the purposes of Superfund standards. You particularly were talking about soils. And the answer is yes. EPA Region 5 has currently accepted the Leech Lake of Ojibwe Hazardous Substance Control Act and their standards for dioxins in soils as the cleanup levels for that particular site, and it's incorporated into the preferred remedy. The other thing is that EPA is also looking at, as a to be considered, a tribal land use plans and resolutions where all of the lands within the exterior boundaries are considered lands to be acquired in the future and therefore must meet the tribal standards, which therefore results in the application of tribal law to fee or trust land within the exterior boundaries. And those are increasingly becoming the policies of tribal governments to ensure that land reacquisition does not result in the land being barred from reacquisition due to contamination, and therefore the BIA will not approve the transfer into trust. And the final thing I want to mention is that if this is, it seems that this pressing issue of not having a definition of the trust responsibility, probably one option is to, for this body to request the Office of General Counsel to provide an opinion on that matter so that there may be an appropriate standard nationwide where EPA recognizes and has a means to implement the trust responsibility, because it is an overriding issue, as you've described.
Yeah, and there's also a need to specifically define it in terms of the Superfund program. I think you're right. I mean, some of the things we identified, you know, we had lawyers participating in some of these interviews, and it was clear that answers were going to need to come from some issues from higher up, you know, in order to really resolve some of these issues. But thank you for providing that update on the the legal status of ARRs, because as we were doing the study in 2010, some of the tribal members and lawyers identified the issue of soil standards and hazardous waste standards as something they were going to start trying to move, you know, however they needed to move that with the agencies, either through, you know, negotiation or litigation or, you know.
Right. Just one final comment would be that if this is not unique within Indian country, the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation, the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, Spokane Tribe of Indians, and a number of other tribes have adopted their own tribal Superfund statute, as many states have, which include both the setting standards for media as well as including a natural resource damage provision. So the body of tribal law is growing and needs to be looked to as a basis for helping to define, you know, what is going to be a satisfactory cleanup to the, you know, the long vision of tribal concerns on reservation lands. So it is an evolving area, but there is a growing body of jurisprudence in that area.
Yeah, and even interesting is like the case of the Navajo, where they have their own EPA, and the relationship of that EPA with the U.S. EPA. You know, we did see sites being delegated to the Navajo EPA, but then ultimately needing to work back through the U.S. EPA in terms of final resolution. But that was an interesting relationship, too, because then we had a tribal agency who was sort of playing the role of the federal agency and encountering some of the same, not all of the same because they had more cultural awareness, but some of the same issues just by virtue of being an agency with rules and policies and regulations. No, and that was interesting, feeling a little bit caught between U.S. EPA and tribal members. Any other contributions, thoughts, questions? You know, one possibility is that if that's occurring in a given region, to get that information out to the other regions. Because one of the things we did see was really different implementation policies on consultation in different regions, also different degrees of openness to tribal risk assessment scenarios in different regions. So to the extent we can get some of these tools that are being developed, both legal and technical, in individual regions out to the other regions for consideration or use, that would be helpful. I know tribes are coordinating more amongst themselves to educate the agencies, but it would be good if the agency was also doing that.
That's a great point, Teresa. Thank you for joining me on this presentation and for, of course, all your hard work on putting together the report itself. Are there any final comments or thoughts before I hand it back to Michael to do a clue and wrap up? Hearing none, take it away, Michael.
Thanks. I'd like to take the time here to thank both Anna and Teresa for an informative presentation today. If you would like to get in touch with them, we have conveniently put their contact information on slide one of the seminar, and they've also provided their information later in the seminar, in the slides in the seminar. I would like to point out slide 38. Again, we have our additional resources link, and more importantly, the feedback form. If you could go ahead and fill that out for us, it would provide us some, you know, some helpful information to help improve the experience, as well as you have the ability at the end of your, when you submit the feedback form, to print out a certificate, if you will, of your attendance today. So with that, we thank you for attending today's edition of NARPM Presents on CLUIN. Thank you.